We'll sort of come to order without a quorum. We have one item on our agenda today. And plus any bills anybody wants to bring up afterward, we'll be happy to talk about those. Anyway, how long is their presentation?
25 minutes, maybe.
All right, and I'm sure there'll be a few questions. So we can go and proceed and introduce yourself. And I believe there's a copy of the report in all our folders, right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, my name is Joel Alter. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I was the project manager for the evaluation that we're going to be giving you an overview of today. And with me today is Carrie Meyerhoff, who also worked with me, and we're certainly available for questions as they come up. Let me begin, before getting into the details, with kind of an overview of what you're going to be hearing about today in this report. And first, let me emphasize that personal care assistance is a program that has the potential to help many low-income people, people facing very challenging life circumstances, lead fuller and more independent lives. And for this reason, this is a very important program for the state. Second, however, the state's PCA costs have grown a lot in the last few years. And even if PCA services are a last resort because other services are not available, it would be very difficult to sustain the kinds of increases that we've seen in the last few years. Third, and this is what I'll be talking about in some detail today, there are some important weaknesses in PCA services. The fiscal integrity of the program is threatened by a high incidence of improper payments. The state's oversight of service quality has been insufficient, and we think there's room for inconsistency in the way assessments are now done of individuals' need for services. So what I'm going to do is give you a little bit of background on the program, talk a little bit about the overall costs, and then we'll go one by one through those three areas needing attention. Let me begin by talking about what exactly we mean by personal care assistance. When you talk about health care, we often talk about the kind of high cost, high credential, high visibility types of services. And PCA is a little bit different. It's a very hands-on service. The people who deliver it are paid modest wages. Basically, there are four categories of service that come under the broad umbrella of personal care assistance. First, there is assistance with what are called activities of daily living. These would be things like helping someone with getting dressed or grooming, eating. A second type of service would be assistance with health-related functions. These are services that usually would be provided by a medical professional, but they've been delegated in this case to a PCA. Changing the dressing on a wound might be an example of a health-related function. A third type of activity is what's called behavior redirection or intervention. A PCA is not supposed to be providing therapy, but they could intervene. Let's say if a child is threatening to hit a sibling or something like that, they could try to redirect the child. And then fourth is a category of services known as instrumental activities of daily living, things like helping with grocery shopping or meal preparation. And a recipient cannot just receive services in this area, but if they're receiving help in one of these other three areas, they can receive help in this area too. The people who receive PCA services are receiving them because first they meet certain income and eligibility requirements as part of Minnesota's healthcare program, primarily Medicaid. What I'd like to do in this slide is just walk you briefly through the process that someone would follow to get services. And that process begins with assessment. This would be assessment of the person's health and their need for PCA services. The assessment is typically done by a local public health nurse. It usually takes about 1 hour during a home visit. The nurse would determine whether or not the person can direct his or her own care. If not, there would be a responsible party designated for that person. And then the nurse would recommend whether the person should get PCA services, and if so, how much. A majority of PCA recipients get their health care on a fee-for-service basis from the state, and for these people, there would be, as a second step, an authorization of services by the Department of Human Services. And that would be telling basically how many hours of service they're authorized to receive. By this point in the process, the person has probably selected a PCA provider agency to administer services, and I'll say a little bit more about those agencies in a moment. They typically are private, non-governmental organizations. But after services have been authorized, the provider agency would contact the individual doctor and obtain a statement that BPA services are medically necessary. The next step would be development of an individualized care plan. This would always involve the recipient. It would involve the recipient or the responsible party. It might also involve the provider agency, perhaps a qualified professional, perhaps a physician. And then finally, the services would actually be provided to the individual based on that care plan that was developed. Now, I mentioned a minute ago that the provider agencies play an important role in the delivery of PCA services. When Minnesota started with the PCA program about 30 years ago, caregivers used to send their bills directly to DHS. DHS would make payments directly to the caregivers, but the program grew and it became unwieldy to do that. Today we have more than 500 provider agencies that do a lot of the daily administration of services. Many of these are very small. They have relatively few recipients. Often they'll operate out of someone's home office. It might be a small storefront that they operate from. There is no requirement in state law for these agencies to have state licenses, and over three-fourths of them are in fact not licensed. State law provides for two general types of PCA provider agencies. The first is what's called personal care provider organizations. The second are called PCA choice agencies. Both of these types of agencies do certain fiscal tasks, submitting bills to the state, making payments to the PCA. But if you are in a PCA choice agency, there are certain tasks that the recipient would be doing that in a personal care provider organization would be done by the agency. Those would be things like hiring, firing, scheduling, supervision of the services being provided.
Mr. Off, let me interrupt you. We're going to call the meeting to order, so now you actually can go on the record. And while we're doing that, Chair Humphrey has a unique opportunity to actually move the minutes for approval. And
move the minutes.
Yeah, how about that, huh? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? They're adopted. Okay, Mr. Alter, thank you.
The vast majority of the funding for PCA services is from the Medicaid program. And as you know, there's a 50-50 split of state and federal costs in Medicaid. Over the last few years, the costs for this program overall have grown sharply. Between fiscal years 2002 and 2007, total spending grew by 164%. And let me just break that down for you into the managed care and the fee-for-service shares. On the managed care side, spending during this period grew at an annual rate of about 35%. On the fee-for-service side, spending grew at about 18% per year. And altogether, the spending grew from about $150 million in 2002 to just over $400 million in 2007. Some of the reasons for those cost increases. First, I want to emphasize that the growth that I showed you in that previous slide was due entirely to growth in the number of recipients as opposed to growth in the cost per recipient. So we've seen an expansion of the pie, an expansion of the total number of people who are participants in this program. Second, since the time the PCA services started in Minnesota 30 years ago, the legislature has expanded who is eligible to receive the services. In addition, there has been an expansion of which parties are eligible to serve as paid caregivers. And third, there are and have been some limits on the availability of other services that has probably contributed to greater use of PCA. The state has been, as you know, phasing out regional treatment centers. We're trying to reduce numbers in nursing homes and in intermediate care facilities. We've had some caps on Medicaid waivers in recent years. All of those have probably also placed new pressure on the PCA program. What I'd like to do next is to walk through those three issues that I highlighted at the beginning, one by one. And I want to start because we're talking about a program that does involve expenditure of $400 million by talking about fiscal integrity, because it's important to ensure that taxpayer dollars are spent wisely. $400 million in the scheme of the overall Medicaid program is big, but I think it's important to keep some perspective. It's less than 10% of Medicaid spending. On the other hand, the share of the state's fraud investigation resources that are devoted to PCA services has been substantial. In the case of DHS fraud investigators, they estimated that nearly two-thirds of their time is spent on PCA-related issues. And in the case of the Attorney General's office, over the last 3 years, they've spent nearly half of their time on PCA-related cases. And I'd like to say that that provides us with some assurance that we're getting to the bottom of all of the fraud and improper payments, but there have been limits to what the investigators have been able to look at and uncover. Most DHS investigations are initiated by a complaint. DHS would like to be doing random audits, but they frankly have not had time to do that in the last few years. From what we saw, the DHS fraud investigations are done very well, and they're well documented, but they're also oftentimes narrow in scope, often focusing on a single recipient or a single caregiver. In cases where there is collusion between a recipient and a caregiver, it can be very difficult to detect this unless there's some type of actual direct surveillance. And usually there is not surveillance of the recipient or the caregiver unless there's involvement of a federal agency like the FBI, which doesn't happen real often. So the bottom line is that because the scope of the investigation is often limited, and because there is a limit to what these activities can actually detect, there really has been no strong basis for estimating the total extent of improper payments in the PCA program. In our report, we talked some about improvements that DHS has made in the last couple of years to try to improve its ability to detect fraud. And I can certainly talk about those today. Nevertheless, as we looked into the program in more depth, we did find evidence of some obvious problems when we reviewed claims data in depth. And we reviewed 1 month's worth of PCA claims from the middle of 2008. One of the things we found was many instances in which providers were paid for more than 24 hours per day for an individual caregiver. And in one case, the extreme example, 254 hours of service reported by one PCA in a day in which the claim was actually paid. We also identified many other instances in which providers were paid for PCAs who reportedly worked consecutive 24-hour workdays, which seems implausible or certainly questionable.
Mr. Alpe, you've generated a question from Representative Fox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the claim, the 254 hours, I mean, that's something that we've heard a lot of, and I've been hearing conflicting reports on that in fact it was just a billing error, that those 254 hours were in fact served to individuals, multiple individuals, but they just used one individual number for that billing claim, even though it turned out to be legitimate. Is that the case?
Mr. Chair and members, here's what I can tell you. First of all, regardless of what explains this case, and I certainly don't know entirely myself, but it is inappropriate to have a system in which we have provider numbers for everyone who is supposed to be providing services and 254 hours reported for an individual provider in one day. What I can tell you is that there were reportedly, for the single provider, 11 different recipients who received services in that day, but they were all reported under a single provider number. Whether this was fraud, whether this was an error, whether it was an agency that was just trying to report a lot of people's work under one provider number, I don't know for sure, and the case is currently under investigation.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll have some other questions for the department afterwards.
Yeah,
about if this is plagued or not.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alder, my question is to the slide prior, you don't have to go back to it, but I'm just curious about the scope of investigations and what you said they're generally narrow related to one incident or one individual. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how the scope is determined.
Mr. Alford.
Mr. Chair, members, and we may want to have the department comment on that. There are certainly circumstances where the department, in the course of investigating a complaint they receive about one individual, may, for whatever reason, they may decide to look at a broader range of cases. And we saw instances where that did occur. But what I can tell you is that the majority of cases are, in fact, narrow. That they've received a complaint, they may not have any particular reason to think that the issues are beyond that case, and so they only look at that case. but as far as what criteria they use to perhaps look at additional cases, I think the department could answer that better than I could.
And they're going to be coming up after this. So go ahead, keep going, Mr. Alter. Thank you. Oh, Governor Hayden has a question while we're stopped here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You look good in that seat, by the way.
Thank you.
Mr. Alter, I just can you give us a sense of, can you give a sense of who complains? Is it the actual folks that are getting the care? Is it relatives? Is it, I mean, how are those fraud claims generated? Are those complaints get to your office or the investigative agency?
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, it could be a variety of things. It can happen because a recipient, let's say, calls the Department of Human Services or calls someone and says, I'm supposed to be getting PCA services, and this person hasn't shown up, and there's a problem here. Sometimes it could be, it could be the county that observes that there is something going on here, or they've received some concerns about the case. It can be another provider. I mean, we saw really quite a few different sources of the complaints. I would say a lot of times the recipients are a part of that. I don't know that it's a majority of the cases in which the recipient is the initial complainant, but it's quite a few.
Okay. Yeah, keep going. Thanks.
One other thing before I move off this slide. I think the concern to us, the examples that are before you here are really obvious cases of improper payments. And so I think the concern is that these are ones that were readily flagged, but they don't represent by any means the majority of PCA payments. And so even if we get a handle on these, there's a question of whether or not we really have a sense of the extent of improper payments elsewhere in the system. As we did our study, we also did a review of a random sample of provider agencies. We went out to them, we went through a sample of their recipient files, and we didn't have to look terribly hard to find examples of non-compliance with some basic state payment requirements. For example, in about 20% of the cases, a little more than that, we found discrepancies between the amount of time claimed by the PCA provider agency and the amount that was documented in their own records. In about 28% of the cases, we found that the recipient's file did not contain an up-to-date physician statement of need, which is what's used to demonstrate a medical need for services. And in about 26% of the cases, we didn't find an up-to-date care plan. And in many additional cases besides that, we found that the care plans were not signed, you know, raising questions about the recipient's role in actually developing the care plan. We also heard a lot of concerns that it is simply too easy to establish a PCA provider agency. These agencies face pretty minimal state requirements in law and rule. Over the last 5 years, there has been a 150% growth in the number of unlicensed provider agencies. There are requirements in the rules, and DHS checks the compliance with some of those requirements before an agency is allowed to start doing business. But we found that for some of the other requirements, DHS does not verify compliance before the agency starts serving recipients. There is training that DHS developed and started implementing at the beginning of 2008. It's a 3-day training program. We think it's good training, but it is voluntary. And as of this time, less than 1/3 of the PCA agencies have had someone complete the training. Also, we heard concerns from DHS that there have been some PCA agencies that have been literally put out of business by DHS, only to reemerge, basically same people running the agency but under a different name, and DHS feels that they haven't had the authority not to enroll those agencies. So let me turn to our recommendations in the area of fiscal integrity and briefly walk through these. First, fairly straightforward one, we think the DHS needs to regularly and promptly analyze data on paid claims to detect improper payments. This doesn't necessarily have to involve something real staff intensive and going out to the actual site. A lot of it can be done from the central office. And DHS has started to do more of this in the last few months, and we think that's good. The second thing is, even in cases, let me back up. As I mentioned before, fraud cases have consumed a lot of DHS's time already. We think it's important to sustain that level of investigation and, if possible, do more. There are a lot of new provider agencies doing business out there. A lot of them don't have a lot of business savvy, and we think that it would be good to get out to more of those agencies. And if DHS can't do it with existing resources, the legislature may wish to consider some type of provider fee. There is none currently for these agencies. Third, some recommendations for the legislature. The legislature should require agencies to complete this intensive training program I mentioned a minute ago before they start doing business. We also think DHS should be authorized in law to consider the track record of provider agencies. If there have been instances where they have not complied with state requirements, that should be considered when they're re-enrolling or seeking to re-enroll. And finally, we think there's room for more clarity and specificity about the boundaries of this program and what can be reimbursed by the state. For example, we sometimes heard DHS telling agencies you can't pay a PCA to help a child do homework, but we couldn't find that in writing. And there were other examples of that, of things that where it was just gray simply because some things that DHS was telling agencies were not in written policy. So we think there's room for a lot of discussion about what those boundaries are. A second area I want to focus on is quality assurance. And this would be the mechanisms that are in place to ensure quality and to protect vulnerable recipients. DHS is supposed to be playing a leading role in quality assurance, but we came to the conclusion that its efforts have been pretty weak. The 2001 legislature directed DHS to develop a PCA-specific quality assurance plan. The law outlined a number of components that was to include, and that was never developed. One of the elements of that required plan was a consumer survey, and DHS did do that in 2003, but that's only happened once, and it's been a few years, and so I think, you know, that's another area that it has been a shortcoming. Until 2006, DHS was one of very few states that was not doing regular reviews of the agencies that were provider agencies for these services. But starting in 2006, partly at the prompting of the legislature, DHS began doing quality assurance reviews. We think the results to date have been disappointing. DHS took staff away from that function, at least some of the staff away from it. The number of agencies that the quality assurance staff have been to has not been particularly large. When problems have been found, typically follow-up has not been done. And we also found that the documentation was not particularly good. So lots of room for improvement in these quality assurance reviews. Another way of helping to ensure the quality of services is through ongoing supervision. The law used to require all recipients to have supervision by what are called qualified professionals. This might be, for example, a nurse. Today, however, recipients are allowed to choose whether they want professional supervision or not. So we reviewed statewide data. What we found was that 22% of PCA recipients in 2007 did not at any time during the year have paid supervision by a professional. And I should mention that that's a percentage that has been increasing over the last few years. In addition, as we went through client files, we saw many cases where the frequency of the supervision that did occur did not appear to comply with what the statutes required. We're uncomfortable with not having a greater level of supervision because we think supervision serves a couple of purposes. In addition to protecting the recipient from harm, it can also provide a measure of accountability to the state for the significant expenditures that occur. By statute, people who receive PCA services are considered vulnerable to maltreatment, and our report highlights a number of issues that raise questions about the adequacy of protections for these individuals. For example, state law requires PCA agencies to develop what are called individual abuse prevention plans for each adult recipient. As we went through files, most of the adults that we reviewed did not have this plan in their files. Another issue is when maltreatment allegations do occur, who does the investigation? Which state or local agency should be doing that? The statutes that assign these responsibilities are very complicated. Even the agencies that are in the business of having to do the investigations are often confused about whose responsibility it is. And so I'll have some recommendations for this in just a moment as well. And finally, we noticed that service recipients have not always received very good consumer information. Recipients are supposed to get a copy of what's called the state's Home Care Bill of Rights. This often doesn't happen. PCA or DHS has a pretty good consumer handbook that provides some help to individual recipients. But in the area of directing recipients to who they should call when a problem arises, what are the resources that are out there, it's not as helpful as it really should be. Let me touch on a few other issues briefly before getting to our recommendations in this area. As we reviewed paid claims for 1 month from 2008, we observed that a lot of PCAs reportedly put in some very long work weeks. And to us, that raised questions either about the quality of care being provided or about the accuracy of the time reporting. Another issue is that state law doesn't specify any minimum amount of training for PCAs, and DHS hasn't really provided guidance about what types of training would be appropriate. So really, you've got provider agencies and recipients that have pretty much been on their own to figure out what types of training their PCAs need. Another issue, more than half of the PCA recipients in Minnesota are people who have behavior issues. And we've heard concerns about whether or not those people are being adequately served by PCA, because as I mentioned earlier, sometimes PCA is used because better, more therapeutic services are not available. This is just an ongoing issue that we raise in the report. There's not an easy solution to it, but I think it's something that DHS and the legislature need to consider. How best to serve these individuals, and what role should PCA play? And finally, we observe that there is really little information about PCA service outcomes. It's difficult to find a good measure of outcomes, and we acknowledge that. But I think it's important to say that, too. Again, this is a $400 million program, and I'd like to be sitting here and be able to tell you something about what we're getting for that. But we don't know a lot. And it's hard for me to say definitively anything about the cost effectiveness of the services. As far as our recommendations, I'll touch on a few of the major ones that we make in the report. First, a couple for DHS. We think the DHS should strengthen the quality assurance program. It needs to get out to a lot more of the provider agencies, see them firsthand, see if they're complying, and when there are problems, do some prompt follow-up. In addition, we think DHS should provide guidance on the topics that personal care assistants need to understand. And we recognize that a lot of the training that goes on is going to be very individualized, that relates to the specific needs of an individual. But there will be other things that are more universal. Might be, what are the proper methods of infection control? How do you fill out a timesheet? Those are things on which DHS could at least provide some guidance about which topics people need training in order to provide services. And some recommendations for the legislature. We think, as I mentioned before, that it's reasonable to expect some level of professional supervision for everyone receiving services, again, by an outside professional. For people who are on a Medicaid waiver program, they generally have a case manager who's going to provide some oversight. But for the people who are on the regular medical assistance program, they typically don't have that. And we think it's important to ensure that there is some professional supervision of these cases. In addition, we think it would be helpful to clarify and streamline statutory responsibilities for whose job it is to investigate maltreatment allegations involving unlicensed PCA agencies. And our recommendation in this report is to give DHS that responsibility, partly because DHS is the agency enrolling these agencies in the PCA program and doing most of the day-to-day administration at the state level. A final area I want to touch on is assessment. And our concern here is the consistency of decisions that are made across the state about who should be receiving PCA services. I think this slide doesn't show up terribly well in your handout, but
Dr. John, let's take a break. Dr. Huntley has a question for you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and Mr. Alter, you said the DHS should be the one that looks at complaints, as opposed to nursing home complaints that are usually done by the Department of Health. Is there some reason for that switch?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, and let's keep in mind that both DHS and the Department of Health currently have staff who do investigations of maltreatment. For agencies that are licensed by the Department of Health, they would generally be doing the maltreatment investigations in most cases. DHS is doing investigations of cases involving some of the foster care agencies and things like that. So both agencies do maltreatment investigation. The issue is we've got all these unlicensed agencies, and who's best to do that? And frankly, one of our concerns was the Department of Health currently has some of this responsibility, but they didn't seem to be aware of it when we contacted them. And they seem to be a little, they seem to be, frankly, a little further removed from the administration of this program, and it concerned us. We thought this is a program, really, that the DHS has the most active involvement with. They, again, enroll the agencies. Hopefully, they're doing the quality assurance reviews. They're doing the compliance reviews. It just seemed like a better fit. And I know one other comment on this. I know there are going to be cases where you have provider agencies that are licensed by both health and human services, which certainly complicates things because then somebody says, well, you know, which agency is the right one to do the investigation? And I don't have a quick answer. I think probably there should be some provision that in those cases, you know, one agency or the other should probably be given responsibility for doing it. But it just seems like there needs to be some clarity here. And again, our recommendation in general to the DHS would be the better place to put that.
Okay, keep going and then, thanks.
Mr. Chair, we noticed a lot of variation among counties in use of PCA services. And, you know, we often see this in human services programs, but we tried to make some adjustments to see exactly how wide the variations were. We adjusted for the number of people on the who were Medicaid eligible, who had disabilities, and even with that adjustment, we found a lot of differences in the rates of service around the state. And just to give you an example from the slide in front of you here, as we look at the very small counties, counties under 50,000 population, it ranged from Beltrami County, which was serving 30 times the number of individuals per 1,000 ME eligible persons with disabilities, compared with Cook County, which was at the low end of the continuum. In the larger counties, you didn't see those extreme differences, but they were big nonetheless. So I think the issue here is one of both unequal access to services, but it also is an issue of just the consistency. Are we around the state following some pretty consistent rules for who gets in the program and who doesn't? One plausible explanation for these types of differences.
Mr. Alty, you have a question. There are questions from Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you're about to answer it, but I was wondering from your interviews whether you got a handle on why, was it the criteria for screening or was it the lack of staff or intent of staff to promote this program, those kinds of things?
Mr. Chairman, members, we called a number of the counties that were kind of at the extremes and talked with them a little bit and heard different explanations. I mean, sometimes it can be that there aren't providers in some parts of the state, so they just don't use PCA services as much. Some of the places in the state, Beltrami County was just up there, now we're way back to the beginning. We'll get back. Beltrami County was at kind of the upper end of the continuum. They've seen over about a 5 or 6 year period literally about a 600% increase in the services. And we talked with them about that, and I remember them saying a couple of things. First was they've had a lot of new providers in their area, and they said those providers have been out recruiting, making people aware of their eligibility, but also trying to actively get people to take advantage of the services. But I also remember that Beltrami expressed some concern as well about the consistency of the assessors within the county, and whether they were always, again, whether some people were declaring some people to need PCA services that other assessors weren't. And that's why, once I get back to the right slide here, I do want to focus on assessment, because I think that even though that's not the only explanation here, that's certainly a part of the picture. What we there are assessors, as I mentioned at the outset, who are looking at a person, determining whether there is a need for services, and then making a recommendation. It's important to ensure that they are well trained. This is a very tough job that they have. They go into somebody's house for about an hour. They don't have a lot of time to observe them, but they're looking at what their needs are and trying to get a handle on that. Many of those nurses are trained and have taken advantage of the state's training, but I should mention that the training is not mandatory, and the availability of that training hasn't always been there at the state level. Training isn't a panacea. Even when people get training, we observe that sometimes their conclusions differ nonetheless. So there have to be some things in addition to training as well, and I'll talk about those in our recommendations in just a moment. We also observe that there is a lack of guidance at the state level. Many of the assessors told us they would like more help. They would like some state guidance about who can receive services, especially when they get to looking at behavior problems. And finally, we've got 87 counties that are doing these assessments, but we haven't had a lot of active state review of the outcomes of those assessments. So our recommendations really are threefold. The first does relate to training. We think that there should be a minimum amount of training that the assessor should be required to go through. But beyond that, we think the state needs to provide some guidance. Guidelines don't have to be used in a rigid way. There should always be some allowance for people who have differing needs. But the assessors need help, and we think some guidelines are a reasonable approach. And then thirdly, we think DHS should do some state-level review. Look at samples of assessment outcomes, look at summary data, something to get a handle on some of those outliers that are out there. One other issue that I want to touch on before wrapping up, and that is the issue, an issue that's been discussed for probably more than 20 years for the legislature, and that is whether PCA provider agencies should be subject to licensure. Previously, the legislature has actually passed some licensure requirements for personal care agencies. Ultimately, however, the legislature has backed off when the price tag has become known. And we assume that the price tag would be substantial today. There are many more provider agencies out there today than there were a few years ago. So that's a consideration. The 2008 legislature temporarily exempted all Medicaid-funded PCA provider agencies from licensure. It did this pending the implementation of new provider standards. These are to be developed in response to recommendations from the Department of Health. The Department of Health is supposed to come out with those recommendations next month. Here's what I can tell you. We favor more and better oversight of PCA provider agencies, and that could happen in different ways. It could certainly happen through licensure, but we think it could also happen through mechanisms other than licensure. I mentioned earlier, we've got an enrollment process at DHS for these agencies. We've got quality assurance reviews that should be done. We've got compliance audits. All of these are mechanisms for oversight and for ensuring that standards are met. And so at a time when resources are scarce, our view is to perhaps start with those mechanisms first, even though licensure should certainly be considered as a backup. So let me just sum up, and then we'll see what questions you may have. Overall, personal care assistance is important. It's an important part of our publicly funded health care programs. At the same time, the costs have gone up a lot, and they would be hard to sustain in the future, especially if we don't have harder evidence about what we're getting for those expenditures. There's also a need to improve the accountability, the quality, and the consistency of PCA services, and that's going to require a more active state role. And finally, I think it's important to emphasize the need to do something on this now. We're still not at the end of the curve, but we're somewhere in the middle as far as the aging of our population. We're going to see a lot more elderly people, presumably a lot more people who need home care services in the next few years. And so whatever steps the legislature and DHS can take today are going to help us get a little bit, hopefully to catch up on the curve and to get a little bit ahead. I think that's it, Mr. Chair. I should add one thing, and that is that at the back of the full report, there is a list of all of the recommendations in the report, which legislators often find helpful. Thank you very much.
And thanks. And there may be some more questions. Representative Howe has one in a second. I think we'll take that one, and then we'll move to the department's response. And after Matt Dean asked his question, then we'll move to the department response, and they'll talk for a while. And that'll give us quite a bit of time to balance out the two. So, Representative
Thomas. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have data, or did you look at the family members serving a client who is also a family member? I assume that's the case. His grandson is supposed to be helping grandma, and he doesn't do it. I assume she won't complain. And so is that part of the assessment as well? Or?
Mr. Dolphin.
Mr. Chair, members, let me offer a couple of comments on this. This is an important issue that I haven't touched on yet. Some family members are allowed to serve as personal care assistants. The main restrictions are you cannot serve as a personal care assistant to your spouse, and you cannot serve as a personal care assistant to a minor child. But cousins, aunts, and uncles, I mean, there are many other, obviously, relatives who could serve as a personal care assistant, and that's been the practice for a number of years. It wasn't the case 30 years ago when this program started, but over time the legislature has had some comfort with expanding this program to relatives as paid caregivers. I would like to be able to tell you exactly what portion of the state's 40,000 PCAs are serving a relative. There simply are no data on that. There are no reliable data on that. It's something that we looked for early on and found out there just is nothing at the Department of Human Services that would shed any light on that. As we went out to provider agencies, we certainly talked with them about that. And what I can tell you is that particularly in some of the areas in the Twin Cities and elsewhere, but especially in the Twin Cities that serve immigrant populations, there's a lot of use of PCA services with paid caregivers who are relatives. 80-90% of some of the agency's business involves relatives serving as caregivers. We heard some concerns about that. There were cases where some of the provider agencies said to us, you know, it's just not appropriate. We don't allow that for our recipients because we don't think there are proper boundaries when a relative is serving as a caregiver. But we also heard the flip side from people who said, you know, many of our recipients are just not comfortable with having a stranger come into their home, particularly people who are recent immigrants. They want somebody they can trust. They want somebody who they feel a little bit more comfortable with and that has a personal stake in their care. Our recommendation on this is really for no change in the current policy. We didn't feel there was a compelling case to be made for further restricting who can be a paid caregiver. We think there's an argument to be made for allowing relatives to serve as paid caregivers. But again, I wish I could tell you what the trend has been over time and how much that has grown.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Alter, my question is going to go to page 11 of your full report, which details the places where the money comes from in addition to cash. The eight different services, starting out at medical assistance on the top, and it shows Medicaid. You talked about the difference between MA and community-based waivers, Minnesota Care, Alternative Care. In looking at these different revenue sources in your investigation, did you come across significant instances where more than one agency was being billed for the same service?
Mr. Austin.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm not sure I understand the question, but let me just clarify that when a PCA provides a service to a recipient, the agency that PCA works for would submit the bill to the state on behalf of that PCA and then ultimately make payment to the PCA. So just to clarify, is your question whether or not there is an opportunity for more than one personal care assistant or more than one agency to submit a bill on behalf of a single recipient, or am I misunderstanding?
Perhaps I'm misunderstanding. I don't understand how these services are billed out, but is it possible that the same service could be paid for from two different sources?
Mr. Alford.
Mr. Chair, as far in the page you're pointing to, which shows different programs, I mean, each individual should be under a single program. So I don't think there should be an issue there. A person should only be eligible for one category of these services. At the same time, you know, again, we didn't think it was possible for somebody to receive more than 24 hours of service and be paid for that. So I don't want to rule out the possibility that there might be opportunities for some sort of double billing.
Yes, Cindy.
And for those in other states where there is dual eligibility in particular, they have had difficulties with double billing. And just in looking at the staggering cost of this, $250 million over 5 years, if you think about that, that's $50 million per year increase within this program, over $400 million per year. If we could just take 10% of that, we could pay for all of the programs that we were lamenting were being proposed to be cut on the for our healthy conditions grants that were going out. My next question is, if we do have fraud and we do have abuse and we do have overbilling, we can have recommendations for how to avoid that, but how can the state retrieve those costs if in fact we have been overbilled? Why can't we go back and get the money?
Mr. Alter, maybe the department will comment when they come about that.
Mr. Chair, that's fine, and certainly they can seek repayment.
Is that what you want to say? Okay, well, why don't we have the department come up, and then we'll, we need to move to the department, and then there'll be time for dialogue. Mr. Coleman, are you by yourself, or you got Alex with you? Come on up. Do you wish to have a period of time to say some things, and then we'll question you after that? We've got 40 minutes altogether, and so...
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Welcome.
Chair. I won't take all 40 minutes.
Oh, that's okay. That's a good thing.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's good to see you all again. I'm Lauren Coleman, for the record, the Assistant Commissioner at DHS for Continuing Care. And with me is...
I'm Alex Bartolik. I'm the Director of Disability Services at the Department of Human Services.
Thank you for the time to provide some comments about the PCA services and the... OLA evaluation. First, I would like to thank Mr. Nobles, Mr. Alter, and Ms. Meyerhoff for a balanced report, and we support the recommendations contained therein. Just as a little bit of history, we started PCA services in Minnesota in 1977 for people with physical disabilities who could direct their own care and the PCAs that were providing that service. Over time, Minnesota has chosen to expand the program to other individuals, such as people with developmental disabilities, people with behavioral and mental health needs, and those that cannot direct their own care, but who have a responsible party. The recent expansion that you've seen trended for you over the last several years is due to several factors. First, the deinstitutionalization and the federal requirement to provide service in the least restrictive setting. We've had limits on our disability waiver programs enrollment for the past several years, and the availability of other services or settings in the community are factors. The last 5 years' growth has caught the attention of the department, the legislature, health plans, consumers, advocates, and then again, most recently, the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We've attempted to manage through the growth with a number of actions that have led to some improvements. Examples are, as already been mentioned, the PCA Consumer Survey in 2003, followed by training for public health nurses, a PCA handbook that was developed for consumers, initiated meetings with various stakeholders to initiate the rewrite of the home care statute, documentation and forms revision, implementation of timesheets for personal care attendants in 2005, requiring all personal care attendants to enroll in our program and receive a unique identifying number to match up their services with consumers and the resultant criminal background check monitoring. Changes to the PCA assessment form, training that you've heard about. A couple years ago, we tried to address the pooling of PCA hours. and most recently in 2008, initiating a home care advisory task force. We strongly agree that additional improvements are needed. And although I know it will be tempting, I will be back here next week, February 3rd, to present our PCA reform legislative proposal in detail. And but let me mention a couple things about that proposal as a prelude for that presentation. We are approaching the program from the standpoint of needing to address the sustainability of the program over the long term. We recognize the growth that we've experienced is unsustainable. The items that are being identified here within this report need to be addressed. We need to change access to the program to focus on those that are most appropriate to participate. Again, Minnesota has widened the scope of who may be eligible to access this program, and we have recommendations about how to define that differently. We will be proposing a limit on the number of hours that a personal care attendant can work. On the assessment side, which you heard Mr. Alter talk about, and the feedback that he received from many that he interviewed, we do believe that we need to improve the assessment. That's where it all begins, trying to determine what the needs of an individual would look like. And within our legislative package, we have a proposal to implement what we refer to as COMPASS, which is a comprehensive assessment tool that would apply to all populations in all of our long-term care programs as we phase it in. It is one of the deficits that we have in that we don't have a comprehensive database on the needs of all the people in our long-term care programs. We need it in order to assure consistency, accuracy, and that we are focusing the services that are being provided on the needs of the individual, incorporating the informal supports that are already available within their lives. We are proposing that we will certify the assessors, that we will have a training, a curriculum, and that the individuals who are using the COMPASS tool to do the assessment, typically the public health nurses or other nurses, would be certified by the department that they have gone through the training and they have demonstrated competency in utilizing the tool. We're going to streamline the assessment. The COMPASS tool will collapse several current assessment tools into one comprehensive assessment. Doesn't mean it has to be longer. It just will be a single tool with modules to it so that it is user-friendly and we don't have to have consumers going through multiple assessment processes. And we will simplify the protocols, and you'll hear more about that next week, for the assessors in determining how to match up the needs of the individual with the authorization of hours. We will make training mandatory in our recommendations for all of those that who are involved, the PCA agencies, the staff, the professionals that oversee the staff. We will have clear standards in our proposal for the providers. We will require ongoing supervision from a qualified professional that is involved in the lives of the consumers. We will have annual enrollment requirements for the agency, the PCPO or the PCA Choice. They will have mandatory requirements. They will be enrolled through our provider enrollment unit, and they will have to demonstrate business practices, or they will not be eligible in our proposal to continue to provide those services. Last, but certainly not least, it is very difficult to measure the outcomes in this program, but it's also difficult to measure the outcomes in all of our home and community-based services. But we are following the good work that we've done on the nursing facility side in developing outcome measures with stakeholders taking time. We have a long-term care expert panel that has been meeting and convening over the last year to determine what are the most critical elements in a person's life. How do we measure those? How do we collect the data? Our goal is to be able to provide information to consumers, families, others about the quality of services that an agency is providing, not only in this program, but all of our home and community-based programs. We're not there yet, but we are making progress. And my last comment is this is a large program. I don't believe we will ever complete examining and improving this program. Part of our proposal will have an ongoing evaluation of how are we doing, monitoring this program and the changes that we are proposing to make, and likely will be before you every other legislative session to recommend improvements to this program. We see it as a valuable tool, but needs to be redefined in light of its current growth pattern. So, Mr. Chair, questions?
Thank you. There are a couple, and it's good you're here. So, Rep. Cinnabon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you again. Thank you for coming in. This issue of outcomes, one thing that occurs to me, often it's spoken that the PCA services, it's often said, would decrease the number of individuals that would be in more restrictive settings and potentially and most likely more expensive settings, you know, group homes, nursing facilities, integrated care, etc. If that statement is true, one would think that one could look at this data we were shown, you know, the differences in the counties and say, well, for every 1,000, you know, eligible type folks, is the county that shows more CCA services, do they have fewer people in these less restrictive settings, for example, you know, that would be eligible? Or other states, we hear some states, you know, cap it at 2 hours a week or whatever the number might be, but something lower than our average. Do they first 1,000 potentially eligible population that could qualify for their services have people, more people in restrictive settings than we do? And is that linked to our provision of PCA services? So it seems like that seems a major trade-off that we hear about. And my question is, has any of that type of analysis been done? Do we have the data even to kind of get a hold of that question, or other kinds of information that may inform whether there in fact has been in this trade-off and we have gotten something for our additional dollar?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bond, there's a lot of questions in there and a lot of fuel for thought. The PCA program, clearly by our data, is a cost-effective program. It is the one of the least expensive long-term care programs that we have. So if we compare it to the cost of institutionalization or other programs, or even the waivers themselves, it's a reasonable purchase. Now, it's difficult to ascertain, would all of the individuals who are currently receiving PCA services or even waiver services, would they be in an institution in today's world if those were not available? Certainly many would be. Certainly their needs are such that they do need some support, but I don't think we could clearly say that they would all have found their way to an institution. It's a bit of a balance. We're trying to rely less on the institutional side, fewer nursing home beds, regional treatment centers, ICFMRs, Rule 36s, while the growth on the home and community-based side has been increasing. I think we will know better, and I know this may appear to skirt the question a bit, but when we have Compass fully implemented, so we have a database that is based upon people's needs, as opposed to their desires and their wants and a less objective assessment, we'll have a better way of determining where those individuals might land for absence of a program. There were lots of elements in there.
Maybe part of the question she had was, do the counties that have a way higher incidence of PCA use have a lower rate of institutionalization than those that have a low PCA use? Do you know that offhand?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that offhand. I think that's a factor, but there are other services available, whether you have family available, whether you have the informal supports in your neighborhood. We can certainly look at that data to see if there is a correlation.
Just a quick follow-up. When we heard the anecdote about, I think it was Beltrami, where the huge increase in part of the story was providers moved in and were recruiting, you know, actively marketing their services and recruiting folks. Where were they recruiting them from? Can we do a survey of that county and find out, well, where were you prior to receiving PCA? Were they recruited out of a facility back into a home? Or were most of those folks in home not taking advantage of the intermediate higher lists as they may have actually qualified for, but not taking, somehow getting along some other way, and then they recruited them into the program? So it seems like one could sample and survey that kind of just that one county and gain a lot of insight for what, from what's actually going on.
We'll take an activation, I think. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Coleman. Throughout this discussion, I'm kind of curious about provider agencies that may not take publicly funded payments. They're private pay only, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, an agency that just does it for cash or whatnot, and I'm trying to figure out how they fit in. Would DHS monitor those organizations as well, and if so, would they be part of the legislative reform proposal? And the reason I ask is because I had a constituent who I know paid cash for the services and was very unhappy with the results of the PCA that she had hired, this agency that she'd hired it through. And I'm just wondering if someone files a complaint like that, does DHS look into it, or how do they fit into this whole picture?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. The number of agencies that would not participate in medical services would be quite few. They're likely to be licensed, and if they are a licensed home care agency, that would, again, fall under the health department home care licensure requirements, and would be investigated from that standpoint. Proposals that we are addressing here would be to become a provider in our network for our public programs and those requirements, and we're not proposing to license private agencies in that regard.
And just to, let me ask you, you can go after this. Can you explain why some are licensed and some aren't? Just in the short version, I see Mr. Kerber there, but is there a short answer about why some don't need to be licensed and some do?
Mr. Chair, I believe it's generally accepted that if they are providing, and Mr. Kerber will correct me if I'm wrong, if they're licensed as a home care agency under certain classes, most notably if they're Medicare certified, so they're providing that level of service as opposed to strict personal care attendance, then they wouldn't need to fall under those home care licensure rules of the health department.
So if they're licensed somewhere else, is everybody covered by somebody, or are some places not licensed or scrutinized by anybody?
Mr. Chair, most of the PCPOs agencies that we're dealing with here are not licensed.
By anybody?
By anyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Coleman. So what would a person who independently hired a personal care attendant that wasn't part of the medical assistance program, wasn't registered with your agency, what would they do if they had what would be their protection if they had concerns or problems other than firing them, say if there was you know, things that just shouldn't be going on, what would they do then? Would they just file filing a criminal complaint or whatnot?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, they are still, if they're considered a vulnerable adult, they still have a mechanism to report or complain under the Vulnerable Adult Act, which would then be investigated by the state and county depending upon the considerations. So there's still a mechanism for all consumers who are considered vulnerable. Go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I guess what I was more concerned about, and you don't have to answer this, is not necessarily an instance of, you know, abusing a vulnerable adult, but in the instance of the person I talked to specifically said that she had consistently worked through agencies that would send PCAs over who would sit and watch TV, not do what they ask, things like that. So it's not a situation where where it was an abuse situation. It was just plain not doing what they were hired to do. And, you know, obviously she can fire them then, but if it's a situation where she can't find one that she feels is a good, doesn't qualify for any of these programs, I was just trying to get at that. And we can, you know, we can talk on it offline,
okay,
too. That's fine.
Ms. Bartolik, you've come all this way. I have a question for you, and you can defer to your friend if you want, but here you are. You know, you have to. Did somebody really get paid for working more than 24 hours after 24 hours? Was there a check written to somebody for that?
Mr. Chair, we do have someone else from the department who can talk about the specifics of that situation. There are no edits in our system that would prevent a claim for more than 24 hours to be paid.
Yeah,
but there is a story behind this, and I can have someone else come up.
Maybe they can work on that. I was just surprised how a software would allow that, and I hope that they maybe stop it at 12 hours or something and not just 23.59. And we have a couple more questions that maybe they want to come up, and that might be a question you want to hear, I think, from that was at the topic. And Ms. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to kind of go back to page 11 again of the report and look at where the money comes from and how these services are being billed, particularly through the state services. Could you just talk in general how these services are billed and are paid?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I'll initiate the discussion, but our claims people are here that are far more familiar and intimate with the mechanism. First of all, an individual has to be eligible to participate in one of these public programs, so they have to establish eligibility. What we have done over the last several years with this particular program is register each individual personal care attendant, and there are 38 to 40,000 of them now because of the growth. And we require the agency to bill matching that individual PCA with the consumer so that the system should match those up, that they have provided services on this day for this particular program participant. That was a major change that was implemented, I want to say, 2 to 3 years or so ago. So I'm never going to say never, but it's unlikely that the system would recognize the same PCA providing services to that individual through multiple programs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can you talk about, it goes through the different services. Does Medicare provide payment for any of these services?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I'm not aware that Medicare pays for personal care attendants.
Thank you. And finally, could you just talk a little bit about just oversight and collections within the department? Let's say that you find a provider that has grossly overbilled for months, and it might be tens of thousands of dollars. What mechanisms does the department have to go back and get that money repaid to the state?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, again, I'll initiate it, but the people who work in that area are hearing to address that. We initiate those investigations where we believe that there is behavior that's not allowed within the rules. If it's fraudulent like that, we will work with the Attorney General's office to pursue action against that agency.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Vicki Quinners from the Department of Human Services, and my responsibility is around the fraud and abuse of billing oversight. And in response to your question about recoveries, our investigations, when they find an abusive pattern of billing, we move to recovery of inappropriate billing where possible. And if there's a clear established pattern, as Assistant Commissioner Coleman described, we refer it to the Attorney General's office for prosecution if there is a likely case that fraud can be proven. And in serious cases, we sever the organization's ability to bill us in the future. Sometimes it's an incident of an individual PCA, and where it's clearly an individual PCA situation, we can pull them from the registry that they cannot be paid through our program. But generally, like the example of the 250-some hours, I can't give you details of specific cases that are under current investigation, but generally when we find that a provider has not enrolled all their PCAs, and so they had one or two PCAs that were legitimate with a legitimate registry, and so they knew we wouldn't accept a bill except from a legitimate PCA that got a background check cleared and was fully enrolled. And so they dumped all the hours on one or two PCAs. And we are going through cases like that. And as Alex Bartholik mentioned, the edits in place that will stop that at the 24-hour limit at this point, that's in place now. But we're going back over the cases that have done that before. Sometimes it's that the providers bill against what's authorized, not what's against actually provided. And sometimes they just pile up the hours because they haven't processed their staff correctly. The beauty of the registry, as the Assistant Commissioner described, was in this service compared to like therapy services, we require that they tell us the exact caregiver on the exact day to the specific client. We don't require that for physical therapy or anything like that. But we do in the PCA case because there's been so many issues of abuse by this provider group.
And Ms. Quinnis, how did you decide to stop at 24 hours and not 12 or some more normal number? So you're not going to catch 19 hours?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that limit is always under consideration. And in any one instance, again, I might have to bring Alex back up, there are instances where an actual 24-hour care on an exception basis may well be appropriate. Another edit we're moving toward is an average monthly hour limit, because in any one instance, maybe a 24-hour on a rare exception might be appropriate, but we want to look at the overall pattern of high-volume cases, too, because you might do a 24-hour, but you shouldn't do 24, 24, 24, 24. And that's why we're looking at other edits.
That'd be a long week. Representative Dean, Ms. Kiffmeyer, after that.
I don't know if we're going to find out where this 250 hours comes from or not, but maybe multiple personality or something.
Well,
like
it was
that,
in most cases that we, this isn't the first one, and in most cases it's invariably been multiple clients and multiple PCAs and maybe legitimate services, but those PCAs weren't enrolled and so forth. That's not billable to us.
And just to kind of go back to what I keep going back to, does the department have anything within it, any agency within it for collections, or is that... Does the department have anything within it, any agency within it for collections, or is that vendorized, or is there an aggressive way that you could go back after these overbillings and abuses?
We...
Outside of the Attorney General, but actually going directly back to these folks, either through a vendor or internally, to get these dollars back to the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we, if the provider continues to be a viable provider, we establish on a credit balance basis to take a portion out of every subsequent billing until the amount of the investigation has been recovered from that provider, if they're a viable provider. We just do it directly through our billing process.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Coleman, I think my question, first of all, I just want to thank you for taking the legislative auditor's report and acting on it. I know that sometimes these programs start out smaller, purposeful, and they kind of grow and things happen, and then they need just a whole new look intrinsically of what they're doing. And so you've taken that step, and I look forward to hearing more about that, because we've heard about the problem. I really want to get on to what are we going to do about it, and I look forward to hearing that. But one of the things I want to be sure you include in the future and answer the question now is that when the money is apportioned out, is this done on a county-by-county basis? My reason for that is that if there are some cases where a county might be apportioned it and maybe doesn't have as many clients that want to make use of it, and other counties are short and they have more clients, and is there some way of aggregating so that statewide those who have greatest need get it? And sometimes I know there's this county-by-county structure that can hinder that.
Mr. Coleman. Mr. Cedar, Representative Kiffmeyer. This is entitlement. Anybody who is eligible for this program is entitled, so it is not a county grant in the way that some other programs are made. So no county is limited to the number of individuals who can participate in this program. Now, that's not to say, as we've heard earlier, that there are some counties that use this program more than others. But there isn't a limit on whether a county can provide this service to their community people.
It's forecasting.
Correct.
Representative Haas. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And because oftentimes we like to take the extremes of things and make them the norm, I just want a few things of clarification on the 254 hours of billing by one person. Did the department catch that bill before it was paid? Or did the department catch the request before it was paid out?
Mr. Coleman. Oh, no, Ms. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can't speak to that specific case because it's under investigation. We have been looking at a series of cases that hit high levels that were improbable, in terms of their billing. I'm not sure if we specifically caught that one first, but we've been looking at a number of ones that have absurd billings like that. So that isn't the first one. And we've looked at other ones. So I'm not sure about that specific one.
Okay, thank you. Back to that statement then. The others that you are looking at for absurd billing, have you paid those claims out yet?
Ms. Conner.
Mr. Chair, originally the payments went through. CER's responsibility is post-payment review, and now we're proceeding to go after them.
Representative Haas.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Coleman, in general, I guess I would echo a little bit of what Representative Kiffmeyer was referring to, but this isn't the best reflection on the department in terms of PCA and the recommendations here. And I know on February 3rd we'll be hearing your bill for some of the solutions, but what is your general response to this? Is some of this unwarranted? Are we being given a darker picture than it really is, or do you see some urgency in addressing these things? I'm not sure I'm hearing that right now.
Mr. Abler, Representative Gottwald. No, there is urgency because we view it as a valuable program. It is meeting the needs of many people who are able to live in the community independently. I would say that the growth in the program has overwhelmed us. When the legislation was passed to enroll the personal care attendants and provide them a unique identifying number, it was far greater than we anticipated. So the growth in the agencies, the growth in the service, we've been pedaling to catch up with it. Certainly I value the OLA report. I'd like to say that we would be before you with our recommendations absent the report, because we've been working on this for months. We got the report a couple weeks ago. So we saw the same thing. But to get the solution, get permission to advance this this initiative and work with the legislature to improve this program, is kind of after the rapid growth. I think the decisions that have been made to expand the program were decisions that were made with good intent. When we talked earlier about who has access to this program, the various populations, the various circumstances, the responsible party issue, where people are living, the market got ahead of us. And it's found this program to be of help. And now we need to revisit those issues and be more clear about who should be in, who should be able to offer those services in Minnesota, the agencies, and how we're going to monitor those.
Representative Gottlob. Mr. Chair, just as a follow-up, I appreciate hearing that, Mr. Coleman, because I agree with you. I think the PCA services, when we think about delivery of health care in general and human services in general, a lot more of it is going to be delivered in homes and in the places where people are rather than in institutions and other facilities. And so it's vitally important that we get this right. So I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coleman, I guess a concern and a question. I think the one question I'm going to piggyback on Representative Dean about our ability to recoup the funds that were overbilled and a really good strategy to be able to do that, even if we have to hire someone in which to do that, I think would be really, really important. So I guess I have two comments. So one is really to think about that. I think that is, especially as a legislative auditor talked about, the ability for a organization to stop doing business with you and then rename themselves and then come back and then do it again, I think is really concerning to me that, okay, I owe you $10,000 or $100,000, I'll just, not do business as, Joe's PCA and now I'm Sam's PCA is really concerning. The other question I have is your ability from your perspective, and I guess this is a question, to self-police, to start to see the trends prior to a legislative auditor or someone else coming in and looking at it. This smells and sounds just much like things that happen in the mortgage foreclosure business and others. I know personally that I knew that there were problems in the PCA world from just listening to family members or friends or others that were telling me about these issues. So I guess my question is, what is the mechanism inside the agency to start to identify problems either with growth or trends, less it becoming a big legislative auditor issue and sitting in front of us today?
We have about 2.5 minutes altogether, so go ahead, Mr. Coleman.
Chair, Representative, I'll start. I share your concern. The ability of these providers to transfer them to their secretary or a cousin within 24 hours concerns us greatly. So at least this happens when we go after them. And I think it's about the fact that it's very easy to become these agencies. The standards are very low. We look forward to the health department's recommendation on whether to put in something like a certification or a licensure, because for the most part, when we go into these investigations, we see organizations that don't know how to operate a business and don't know how to keep records. And there is no standard. There's so little standards to become these organizations. They can just transfer the staff and the patients right away to the next entity. And then we've also lost the assets that we could go after because it happens that fast. So we have been surveying our claims data, and we do that regularly. And that's what has developed into the registry staff, the 24-hour edit, and the new one pending that'll be an average monthly limit, things like that to stop the abuse of billing. But the basic integrity of these businesses is really a major question for us.
Yeah, Mr. Hayden.
Just one more follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We don't have a lot of time. Have we been able to understand the potential intimidation that may go on that prevents people from complaining? I know that I've heard of situations in which the person that is a vulnerable adult is intimidated to the point that they don't want to call, or that they don't, you know where I'm going with that. Can you speak a little bit about those claims not even getting to you, or those issues?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we're very aware that coercion between the caregiver and the client can occur, and we're very concerned about that. In other words, if you don't approve this timesheet, I won't come to see you tomorrow or the next day. If the time is, sign this blank timesheet. I think the response to that is what's in part going to be in the proposal Assistant Commissioner Coleman is going to describe, and that is requiring supervision. And from our perspective, and CERS, I'd recommend random spot check supervision to make sure that the PCA has actually shown up, and regular supervision of the situation to make sure that the services are actually being delivered. There has not been resources for that, and there's also provider enrollment requirement to make sure that, you know, the supervisor on staff, that's gonna be pending too. But right now, some of our most vulnerable clients are being cared for by people with no license requirements and the least amount of, you know, professional training or skills, and it's a very vulnerable situation, and we're very concerned. That's also an area, of course, that it's very hard to recover any funds because the client is frightened to testify against the caregiver.
And Ms. Quinn, that has to be about last word. Next week, we have, if you thought this was great, I mean, this is a really good discussion. I commend the department for sitting there and the auditor for doing all their hard work. This is a complex topic. More to come on this. The budget discussions with the DHS starts on Tuesday. For members, budget books are available at Jen's office on Monday if you want to read them over the Monday evening. If that's all we have, right? We're adjourned. Thank you.